the total derivative of the distribution function with respect to t, and setting it equal to this term, which was the thing that was due to collisions, right? So this told us about how the number density of photons with given directions of momenta, recall that mu was just p hat dot k hat. So it was the dot product between the momenta of observed photons and the wave vector of the perturbations that we're talking about. And this term here was the term that you get from Compton scattering, which we didn't derive, I just quoted. But that's nevertheless the term you get, where this thing here, tau dot, was defined as the Thomson cross section times the number density of electrons times the scale factor. So that this, you'll recall, since the number density of electrons goes like 1 over a cubed, this is proportional to 1 over a squared. So this is big in the early universe, deep in radiation domination, and then it becomes less and less relevant later in time. So that's photons. That's basically everything we need to know about photons in the universe is encapsulated in this equation here. There's also equations for the evolution of perturbations in dark matter. So this is what you did yesterday in the tutorial. You studied the non-relativistic limit of these two equations and gravity. So dark matter perturbations basically evolve according to the gravitational potentials. So they don't interact with photons. That's why we call it dark matter. And that's why we don't have any scattering terms here. We have baryons. So the density perturbations for baryons behave just like for dark matter, but the velocity perturbations know about the photons because Compton scattering is going to change the velocity distribution of the electrons. Okay. So for baryons, we have this equation where this constant R was defined as 3 times the energy density in baryons over 4 times the energy density in photons. And I do apologize that all of my rows always look like P's, but you can forget about P's from now on for all intents and purposes unless I'm talking about momenta. So this is how R is defined, okay? 3 rho baryon over rho gamma. And then finally, we have gravity. So we solved Einstein's equations and kept two of them because we have two independent degrees of freedom in this gauge, or any gauge fixed, any gauge we pick. And those were given here. So the first Einstein equation relates the potentials to the energy densities, right? So these are the fluctuations in the energy density for dark matter and photons. And we neglect baryons because in the real universe, they make up a totally pretty much a negligible fraction of the total energy density, okay? So forget about baryons. And then we have this equation, which tells us about the anisotropic stress. That is the stuff that's sourced by the off-diagonal components of the energy momentum tensor, okay, spatial components. So that only gets a contribution from Compton scattering, which was something I told you but didn't have time to derive. But nevertheless, for a perfect fluid, you'll recall that the off-diagonal spatial components of the stress-energy tensor are zero. So I need to do something to make it an imperfect fluid if I want to have anisotropic stress. And these theta 2s, theta 0s, theta 1s are moments of the temperature field. So the moments of the temperature field are just defined by these integrals over Legendre polynomials of the Lth order. Okay. So that's helpful because these different terms, Compton scattering or say the total energy density, only depend on certain moments. So the total energy density just depends on the average, that's theta zero, the average temperature anisotropy. Compton scattering, as it sources the velocity, it depends on the first moment, which kind of makes sense. You might think that a dipole would have something to do with the vector, right? And then anisotropic stress is sourced by the quadrupole, which also you can just wave your hands and say, okay, well, that sort of makes sense because the quadrupole is kind of like a tensor. Okay, so this is sourcing this anisotropic stress. So this is all you need. Okay, we can describe basically everything we know about the density perturbations in dark matter that we observe in the distribution of galaxies, everything about the CMB, everything about gravitational perturbations, everything about how these different potentials are related. All of this comes from this set of equations. Okay, done. So we can go home. Now we know everything about cosmology. So for the next few lectures, we're going to try and unpack all of the information that's contained in this set of equations and try and understand how it relates to what we actually see for the perturbations in the universe. Okay. So our first step along this journey is to try and understand something qualitative about perturbations on different scales. So these k's here came from doing a Fourier transform with respect to a co-moving distance, right? So we had our metric, which I'll write here. So in the unperturbed Robertson-Walker universe, this was just d eta squared plus dx squared. And all of our Fourier transforms, theta as a function of k, as a function of x, this co-moving distance, were defined as d cubed k over 2 pi cubed e to the I k dot x times theta of k. So these are our co-moving wave vectors, right? We're measuring distance according to a co-moving scale. And wave vectors are related to wavelengths by 2 pi over k. So the physical scale is obtained from a co-moving scale by multiplying by a factor of a. So the physical scale is like a dx, right? So physical wavelengths go like 2 pi a over lambda co-moving, and therefore, physical wave numbers go like co-moving wave numbers divided by A. So a fixed co-moving scale will, in an expanding universe, increase in physical size, which makes sense because these waves are basically just expanding with the expansion of the universe, right? That's what it means to be co-moving. And conversely, a fixed kc decreases with the expansion of the universe. So let's draw a picture. This will be kind of a piece of a conformal diagram. So if I really just had a pure Robertson-Walker universe, this is what the conformal diagram looks like, where this is the Big Bang, this is infinity, and this is r equals zero. So let's just take a little piece of this. Let's zoom in on this little piece. So this is, in that small little piece, basically a plot of eta versus some distance scale x, right? And let's consider a fixed wavelength, okay? So I have some fixed co-moving wavelength, lambda c. So if this is, say, the peak of this wave here at the origin, and this is the trough of this wave, then it takes a finite amount of time, because there's a beginning of the universe, for the peak to know about the trough. So light travels on 45-degree lines on this plot, and it's really easy to figure out how long I have to wait in conformal time to see for the peak, to see the trough, right? It's just a total amount of time that's equal to the co-moving wavelength. So there's a distinguished time right here when the peak gets to know about the trough. That is, the whole wave can basically come into causal contact with itself. So if we go back to k's, when k co-moving eta is approximately equal to 1, if we forget about these factors of 2 pi, then this is when peaks are causally connected to troughs. Okay, that's a nice physical scale to keep in mind, right? Because you can imagine that causal physics will change the way that these different wavelengths evolve. So there's another scale that is important to consider, and that is the size of the horizon. Okay, so basically by the horizon, I mean H inverse. So H was defined as 1 over A, dA dt, and we can write that as dA d eta times A, right? No, it's just dA d eta. Sorry. No, that was a little brain glitch. Okay, so this is H, right? That's a physical scale. So H inverse is the physical scale of the horizon, right? That's a physical scale. And we can define a co-moving scale by just putting the appropriate factor of A. So the co-moving horizon is just 1 over A times H. So the co-moving horizon, if we substitute this guy in here, and I don't know what's wrong with me today, but I screwed up again. So A d eta equals dt. So that means I needed a 1 over A squared there, right? So using that, we can rewrite the co-moving horizon as just A over dA d eta. So let's think about how the co-moving horizon behaves in our universe, for example. So in the early part of our universe, the scale factor evolves in a universe that's dominated by first radiation, which then gives rise to a universe that's dominated by matter. So we can write A as a function of eta as the scale factor where we have matter radiation equality times eta over eta star squared, where eta star is just defined as the conformal time of matter radiation equality over square root 2 minus 1 plus 2 times eta over eta star. So I encourage you to try and derive this for yourself. This is actually one of the nice things about working in conformal time. There's a very easy expression for A in any universe filled with matter and radiation. Okay, so now we can look at different limits of this and ask, well, how does the co-moving horizon behave in a universe filled with matter and radiation? So 1 over AH, the co-moving size of the horizon, if you take the derivative and simplify a little bit, is just eta times eta plus eta star over 2 eta plus eta star. And this goes to eta as eta goes to 0. That's for a radiation-dominated universe, during radiation domination. And or we can rewrite that a little bit more precisely as eta much less than eta at matter radiation equality. And it goes to eta over 2 as eta goes to infinity, or at conformal times that are large compared to matter radiation equality. So now on this diagram, we can draw what the co-moving horizon looks like. So it follows the light cone during radiation domination, but then eventually it kind of bends up after matter starts to dominate. So at around eta equality, it bends up. So early in the universe, during radiation domination, this causal condition, you know, when peaks are causally connected to troughs, is just the same as the condition that this wavelength is smaller than the co-moving horizon. Later, during matter domination, that's not exactly true. It changes a little bit, okay? Because the slope of the co-moving horizon bends up just a bit. So when that happens, when k equals ah, this is known as horizon crossing. And you can see that there is a real physical significance to this. At least in the radiation-dominated era, this corresponds to when peaks become causally connected with troughs. So, okay, that's good. So what does this mean for our set of equations that we have over here? So if we want to know the relative importance of the gradient terms, the things with k squareds, we should compare them to the relative size of these terms with the a dots over a. So remember, dot is d conformal time. So if we look at that equation and we just kind of rearrange things a little bit, so for the one Einstein equation, we'll get something that looks like this. And this, dA, d eta, over A, you'll just recognize as 1 over as AH, right? So we see here that whenever we have k squared, or k, much bigger than A dot over A, then these gradient terms here dominate this term here. So this guy is basically just going to be set equal to this guy, and this term is going to be completely negligible as long as I make that ratio big enough. So that corresponds to this non-relativistic limit that you were studying yesterday, because in that limit where I can neglect this term, then you just recover Poisson's equation, right? So in this limit, you get k squared phi equals 4 pi g a squared times these fractional overdensities. Okay. And similarly, if I look at the other equations that I have on the board here, so for example, we've got this velocity term that's got a a dot over a and a k. So in this limit where k is much bigger than the co-moving horizon, you can get rid of this potential term, and then you'll recover the expression for velocities that you found yesterday. Okay, and in this non-relativistic limit, what you found is that at least for the dark matter, which is what you were concentrating on yesterday, that on these scales, so large k means small scales, these overdensities in dark matter basically just undergo collapse in a totally k-independent way. Right? So here we found that dark matter collapses. That is, delta grows. And that was the result. So let me ask you guys a question now. In a universe that is filled with dark energy, how does the co-moving horizon behave? What's that? Yeah. So A is increasing, right? Yeah, so the co-moving horizon is decreasing in size in a universe that's dominated by dark energy. And that contrasts with the case that we were discussing here. In a universe that's dominated by matter and radiation, the co-moving horizon is always growing, right? So what do you think happens to perturbations in the dark matter in a universe that's filled with, that's dominated by dark energy? Yeah, nothing can grow because I can never satisfy this condition that k is much bigger than a dot over a. And indeed, when we solve this full system of equations, that's exactly what we're going to see. So this scale of horizon crossing is going to tell us, you know, sort of roughly under what conditions you can have growth of dark matter perturbations. Kind of a rough equivalence, okay? A rough statement. Okay, so that's what you did yesterday. So maybe this is actually a good point to ask if anyone had any outstanding questions from this tutorial before we go to the opposite limit. Okay,
I have a question on tutorial, but can I just clarify what you mean by dark matter collapses but the perturbation grows?
Yeah, so the perturbations growing corresponds to gravitational collapse. So that's what I mean. So dark matter undergoes gravitational collapse. Okay, so now let's do the opposite limit. So you couldn't do this yesterday because you had this non-relativistic versions of the equations, but these are the fully relativistic versions, so we don't really care about you know, making any approximations about how big H is compared to different things, or how big K is compared to the co-moving horizon. We can just do the full problem. So let's look at the limit where K is much less than 1 over A dot over A. Okay, that corresponds to this limit where things are super horizon. So this is well before things have had a chance to undergo horizon crossing. And again, let's make a little sketch of the universe, one of these sort of pieces of a conformal diagram. So here's the Big Bang. This is eta. This is this co-moving scale x. And let's say that at some early time in the universe, I had some fluctuation in the potential and, you know, the densities and all sorts of stuff, okay? So the solid line is going to denote sort of the peaks, and the absence of a solid line will denote the troughs. So I have at some constant time this plane wave here. And so we could draw sort of a, you know, unpack this, and instead of a space-time diagram, draw an XY diagram. So this would look like over-density, under-density, over-density, under-density, over-density, under-density, something like that, right? And so let's say that I am sitting somewhere, and I'm at a time that's not really too far after this time slice that I've picked, okay? So I look at my past light cone, and then I got a friend over here, he looks at his past light cone, and so on. So what that would look like if I project the past light cone onto this plane is going to be this sequence of guys here, right? Where the radius of these different circles is just equal to the difference in conformal time between this arbitrary observer that I've chosen to put here and this distinguished time slice where I have some perturbation. Okay. So let's say I want to ask, well, what is the temperature distribution, the temperature is a function of angle that these quote observers see in this very early universe. So if they want to see a coherent picture of this fluctuation, then I had better make sure that the photons don't scatter off of a bazillion electrons on their way to me, right? So in that limit, this difference in conformal time has to be really small, because at least in the early universe, scattering is really efficient, and so photons can't travel very far without finding an electron. So that means that the projection of these past light cones onto this density field is going to be tiny. So these are going to be tiny little circles, right? And so, you know, here it's perhaps a little bit hotter than it is here, but the difference is going to be absolutely tiny, right? For all intents and purposes, if I shrink this circle down to zero size, then I just see a uniform temperature. It just depends on who I am, what temperature I see, right? So in these cases, if I can make that approximation, then theta is basically just equal to the zeroth moment, right? Which didn't depend on direction, but it could vary in space and time. So in the very early universe, if I just want to, you know, propagate theta, some small amount in proper time, and I'm in the limit where I have really efficient scattering, then you can see that the monopole is going to be the most important term. Okay, and that's going to be really important. So you can be more quantitative about this. This is kind of a hand-wavy argument. But you can be more quantitative because you actually have the full set of equations, right? So I'll ask you to think about this a little in the homework, and we'll also probably cover this a little bit more on Monday in a little bit more detail. But what this means when scattering is efficient is basically the limit where this optical depth, the time derivative of the optical depth, goes to infinity, right? So this is the thing that controls the strength of the scattering term. And that is determined by, that's proportional to 1 over a squared. So as long as I go early enough in time, I'm in this limit where scattering is extremely efficient. And we can estimate what the corrections are to this. So the corrections are going to come from, well, let's say I look at this limit where eta is basically equal to eta star. Then the angular scale that I'm going to see something on is basically going to be 1 divided by the wavelength of this perturbation. So this is some co-moving wave with a wave vector k, eta naught minus eta star. I guess I picked a very unfortunate choice of notation in this note. Because this has nothing to do with matter radiation equality, so why don't we call that an S? Apologies for that. Okay, and at least for, you know, sort of large L or small angular scales, then delta theta is basically like 1 over L. So if I look at the angular extent, you know, covered by a spherical harmonic with L, the angle is roughly 1 over L. So that means that L, so the variation that I see anything happening on is roughly going to be k eta naught minus eta s. And if eta naught is really close to eta s, then L is going to be really small. Okay. So these higher moments correspond to performing this spherical harmonic transform for these different observers. And as long as their projection of their light cone is tiny, then they're not going to see any variation on those scales. So that's why we can neglect these higher moments, which we will now proceed to do. Okay, so early on, we neglect higher moments. So why can't I neglect higher moments in the late universe? So let's say I tell you that at this time, this is where we have recombination, which is where the number density of electrons goes to 0. So I don't have Compton scattering anymore. Why can't I neglect the higher moments in the late universe? So let's say I put you here, and again, this wave still exists. So would I be able to see more than one wavelength of this wave in the early universe? Yep. Right? So that's my past light cone. Since those photons don't interact with anything from that time until now, then you can see that there's going to be my projection on this past light cone. If this is the surface of last scattering and there's something interesting going on there, is going to be big. Okay. So then the characteristic angular scale on which the temperature varies, you know, it can be small. So that means L can be big, right? I'm going to see a different temperature in different directions in the late universe. Okay, but we're not in the late universe yet. That was just an aside, yeah?
Just to clarify, the delta theta, that's like what you just said, the angular scale on which things vary?
Things are varying, yeah. So in particular, the angular scale on which that delta t over t varies. Okay, so deep in radiation domination, we're just going to set theta L equal to 0 for L bigger than or equal to 1. Okay, so anything but theta 0 is just gone. Okay, we're going to forget about it. So in that limit, we can take our equations over here and pull out all the stuff that just depends on theta 0. So the first thing that we should do is try and find some evolution equation for theta 0. And so in this limit, we're just going to set theta equal to theta 0. Recall that that moment really represented taking theta and writing it as a series over these different theta L's, right? So perform the inverse transform and just keep the first piece, that's just theta 0. Okay, so in this limit, then from that first Boltzmann equation, we're going to get theta 0 dot plus phi dot equals 0. Pretty easy. I guess I should also say, well, we're doing something else, which is let's look at the limit where k goes to 0. So let's look at really large scale stuff. Okay, so we have this equation that comes from the first Boltzmann equation. We have the second equation for dark matter. Okay, so in this limit, we're just going to get that delta dot equals negative 3 phi dot. We've got the equation for the baryons, which that's the same. So we'll get delta dot baryons equals negative 3 phi dot. And then we'll get an equation for the velocities, which is just v dot equals negative a dot over a times v. So immediately we can conclude something from this. In an expanding universe, velocity is just decay in this limit, right? So any peculiar velocities that I start with are just going to decay away. So we just have one equation left. That's the equation for gravity. So let's look at that one. So again, setting k to 0, we're going to get the 3 a dot over a phi dot minus psi a dot over a equals 4 pi g a squared. And then we had this rho matter delta plus 4 rho, what have I been calling that, r theta naught. And I told you we're deep in radiation domination, so that means that rho radiation is much bigger than rho matter. So I'm just going to throw this term away. Okay, and then finally we have the last equation there, which tells us something interesting, which is that phi equals negative psi because we're neglecting all of these higher moments. So that means we're just setting theta 2 to 0. Okay, so now we've got this system of equations, these guys and these guys, and we can solve this. So the first thing we're going to do is, well, we'll note that for radiation domination, we can also say something. So the scale factor just goes like eta. We derived that earlier. Or didn't derive it. I guess I told you to derive it on your own. But anyway, that's true. And we can now just take this Einstein equation and solve it for phi dot. So in doing so, you'll find that phi dot over eta plus phi over eta squared is equal to 2 over eta squared theta naught, where I've noticed that rho radiation 4 pi g a squared is related to h, which I know how to calculate because I know how the scale factor evolves. Okay? So now we can take the conformal time derivative of this guy. We'll call that 1. So we'll take d the eta of this equation. And then substitute for theta 0 dot. From here, so when I take d d eta, it's going to hit that theta naught. So when I do that, at the end of the day, this thing will now simplify into an equation of motion for phi and phi alone. So this will go like 4 over eta phi dot equals 0. And this equation we can solve. So obviously, a constant is a solution to this this differential equation. So phi as a function of eta generally will be some constant. We'll call it C1. And another solution to this equation will be when phi is equal to eta to the minus 3 times constant. So these are the two solutions for phi in the very early universe, deep in radiation domination. And it's got a constant piece and a decaying piece. So if I start with perturbations of the metric that only have this decaying piece, then very quickly I'm not going to have any metric perturbations. So the constant mode is important. So that's one. Now I can take this guy and substitute it back in here, because you'll note I have an equation for theta dot as a function of phi dot and delta dot as a function of phi dot. So if I just care about that constant mode, then theta dot tells me that theta can be some constant. And that's basically it. Okay. So if I fix that over there for phi, then theta naught had better be C1 over 2. And similarly now for delta, if that's true, then delta had also better be a constant. And that should be related to C1 by a factor of 3/2. So in general, you know, I could have in here, I'm confusing myself for some reason. So delta dot is really 3 theta naught dot, making that substitution. So in fact, once I've made this choice for theta naught, I get another free integration constant that I'm allowed to put here. Yeah?
So why theta naught doesn't have an eta dependence?
So theta naught doesn't have an eta dependence because I'm assuming that for phi, I just have the constant mode. So in general, if phi also had that one on eta cubed, then you're right, theta naught would also have eta dependence. But it would also be a decaying mode. So then that would just disappear if it were there. Okay. So these are all these here are the solutions deep in the radiation dominated era. And a constant for both theta naught, phi, and delta is a valid solution. Okay, and these constants are related in this way. Did you have a question?
No, I think I figured it out.
You got it? Okay. So so now we can make a definition before we proceed. Okay. So the number density of dark matter particles and the number density of photons, you can write as the number density today times 1 plus delta over 1 plus 3 theta naught. So this is the first order, the zeroth order piece, and then this is the first order correction to the number density. Number density is just related to delta, right? Proportional to delta. So here, if we have this constant equals to 0, then the number density of dark matter over the number density in photons is not does not vary. In particular, it doesn't vary in space. So these are constants, but in general, they could be some constant. Well, only with respect to eta, they could vary in position. Yeah. Okay, so if that's true, then this ratio of number densities doesn't depend on position, and that's known as an adiabatic initial condition. If this were not true, so if n dark matter over n gamma does vary, that's called an isocurvature. Perturbation. So we have these different choices to make for initial conditions. this one is the one that's supported by observation, but it could have gone either way. So in general, we're going to set this constant to 0 for our initial conditions. So now let's return to this diagrams that we've been making. So here's the Big Bang in this Robertson-Walker universe. And here's this thing that say this is some mode of phi delta and theta naught. And somehow, by the time this gets a chance to cross the horizon, and then delta can start growing so I can get structure and interesting stuff in the universe, somehow it had better be true that I have an initial condition at the Big Bang, say, where I excite this constant mode, right? Because if I excited the decaying mode, there wouldn't be anything around to collapse by the time the mode gets to enter the horizon. Yeah. So that's bizarre, right? Somehow, I need something which gives me a constant perturbation in the gravitational potential, which can then source these other things. Somehow, I have to have this thing lying around since the beginning of time. And next week, we'll talk about the resolution. This is another thing that's in evidence of inflation, because this is in the theory of cosmic inflation, not the beginning of time. But instead, we had some earlier epoch which created this mode. And it created this mode such that I excite the constant mode for phi. So that's going to be important. Okay, but regardless, if I want to have a cosmology period, at this point, I basically just have to assume that I have some constant mode for an initial condition. And then we'll talk more about where it comes from. So now in the last few minutes, So in the last few minutes, let's just play with the solutions to this equation before we move on. Okay. So I need to use the computer for the moment. So as part of your homework, you're going to write a simple Mathematica notebook or use the one that I'll provide you as a template to numerically integrate these equations, because it's only possible to find analytic solutions in various limits. So you found one limit, which was the really small scale stuff in tutorial. We just discussed the other limit, which is the really large scale stuff. And then integrating these numerically will tell you how to do everything in between. Kind of nice. So let's just play and see qualitatively, I don't know, what kind of different solutions might you get. OK, so we'll assume some cosmology. But in our universe, we're going to forget about the baryons. So in this imaginary toy universe, we will just neglect the baryons completely. That's kind of a dumb thing to do if we care about calculating stuff in the CMB and calculating things on relatively small scales. But on large scales, it's not such a bad approximation. And part of the homework will walk you through why that's true. But for now, let's just accept that. So if I only really, at the end of the day, care about what happens, say, to the perturbations in the matter over densities, so the cold dark matter, then also this is a fairly reasonable approximation to make. Okay, so what do we specify? So let's shove in. We have to hold some things constant in our imaginary universe here. So let's say that the epoch of matter radiation equality is what we know it is in our universe from Planck. And let's say we know what the dark energy density is in our universe from Planck. So those are the numbers. The redshift that we have matter radiation equality is about 3400, and the dark energy density is about 0.68. And let's say I start with some potential perturbation that's a constant. Okay. And let's say it's about 10 to the minus 5, which is about right for observations. And then let's specify some wave number. Okay, yeah?
Can you just make it a little bit bigger?
Yeah. I can try. Can you actually zoom? It's not changing the size of the text. Oh, there we go. Thanks. There we go. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, so we'll pick the redshift of matter radiation equality and omega lambda. And then we have to pick some initial size for the potential perturbation, right? And from these conditions that we just derived that unfortunately are behind the screen, the initial conditions for the dark matter overdensity and the photon temperature field will be given just by that initial condition on the potential. They're all linearly related. Yeah. So let's set that to about 10 to the minus 5. That's reasonable. And then we need to specify a wave number. So does anyone remember how big the observable universe is in units of megaparsecs? Yeah, about 3,000. So a wavelength that's about the size of our observable universe is about 1 over 3,000 inverse megaparsecs. Okay. So that gives you an idea for the scales that you might want to pick for K. So another interesting scale would be like the size of the Milky Way galaxy. That's about 30 kiloparsecs. So then if you did 1 over 30 kiloparsecs, that's about 30 inverse megaparsecs or something like that. Okay, so here's some scale. And then we're going to ask what happens today. So A is now. So we can just evolve. I did something wrong. Okay, so we can evolve the equations of motion, and then we can plot what comes out. Okay, so let's look at what happens for phi, for example. So here, the vertical line is the redshift of matter radiation equality. Okay, so well before that, you can see that phi is just constant. Okay, well, we just did that, so that's not entirely surprising that it should be constant. And then matter radiation equality occurs, and you can see that phi slightly decreases. And then at really late time, something more interesting happens, which is that phi starts decreasing much faster. So what do you think happens at much later times to cause that to occur? Yeah, so dark energy starts to dominate. Okay, so now we can look at what happens with delta, the dark matter over density. So delta, as we expected, deep in radiation domination remains constant. And then it starts to grow fairly slowly during radiation domination. So in the tutorial yesterday, you showed that during radiation domination, delta grows only logarithmically in T. So this is a very slow growth of, I think you did. Did you get there? OK. I'll tell you, delta grows logarithmically during radiation domination, and then maybe I'll add that to the homework so you can derive that for yourself. And then matter starts to dominate, and delta can grow much faster, right? So delta, I'm sure you did that one. Delta is gonna grow like A during matter domination, right? Okay, so now theta, so here's what happens to theta naught. It pretty much tracks what's happening with delta, at least on these really large scales. Okay. And then here, I've also calculated these higher moments just to show you that they stay small. They're small, so it was a good idea to neglect these higher moments. And here's what happens to v. Well, it starts zero, it grows a little bit, and then it's going to end up decaying. So it's not just a decaying solution if I wait long enough. Because here I've got a source, so I was neglecting that source before. So it's small, so we grow V a little bit. So then I'll just do one more to contrast this with what happens, say, on really small scales. So let's make this much smaller. So here you can see what happens to phi. So phi enters the horizon during radiation domination, okay? And so it just decays. And then it oscillates a little bit. Any guesses as to why it would oscillate? So it oscillates because phi, at the end of the day, will be coupled to the photons because I'm solving that full system of equations. And during radiation domination, the photons are important. Photons have pressure. So just like the acoustic waves that you found in the tutorial, you get acoustic oscillations of the gravitational potential now because there's a pressure associated with the photons. So here's what happens to delta. Remember that this started at 10 to the minus 5, but now it's had a lot longer to grow because the mode entered the horizon and then was able to evolve much earlier. So now it's grown by a factor of 10 to the 5. So these modes that enter early enough in radiation domination have a chance to grow up into large-scale structure. Right? That's why we see large-scale structure on small scales and not super huge scales, because the super huge scales just haven't had long enough to evolve and collapse into large-scale structure. And here's what happens to theta naught, the temperature distribution field. And so that also undergoes these oscillations. And on Monday, we'll talk about the physical significance of these oscillations. This basically is going to be like the baryon acoustic oscillations, but I don't have baryons here, so it's not exactly the baryon acoustic oscillations. It's just oscillations due to the pressure in the photon field. Okay, and then you can show that theta 1 and theta 2 are small, and here's what happens with V. Okay. So given this thing, you can now answer any question you want about what happens to perturbations in dark matter and the gravitational potential. This will tell you exactly everything you want to know about how these things grow in different universes. So now we could screw with this and say, well, I want a cosmological constant, you know, that's 0.999% of all the energy density in the universe. And you can guess that this is probably going to do some crazy things. So delta doesn't grow as much. It just slops off to be a constant. And then various things change. I guess I need to make it a lot bigger. No, let's make it that big. So eventually what I'll do is I'll make dark energy domination happen like right after matter radiation equality so that these modes just won't get a chance to grow. So that's what happened here, except for I killed it. So in a universe with a cosmological constant that's too big, structure doesn't grow. So here's something to think about over the weekend. Why is the cosmological constant so small in our universe? And I'll leave it there, I guess. We're way over time.